From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Author and journalist Duane Raymond joins us today. He is a contributor to the Huffington Post, and his writing has appeared in a host of newspapers and magazines, and his new book is Mornings with Mailer, a memoir of the time he spent as a friend and editorial aide to the literary giant Norman Mailer. Duane Raymond, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you.
So how did you become involved with Norman Mailer? How did you meet?
Well, I had a career in Boston. I was working as a writer for an NBC News magazine show, and later went on to do some producing for The Real World in Boston. And I really wanted to get back to the core of my writing, so what I did was I kind of packed up, chucked my life, and moved to Provincetown. And, of course, as happens with aspiring writers and people who want to get back to things, I became a waiter. And he wandered into this small restaurant I was working in one night in 2000, and we struck up a conversation, and we had a little nice rapport. And over the next 3 years, we bumped into each other occasionally. And then one night, I just happened to be at the local grocery store here in Provincetown, which is a very small town out at the very tip of Cape Cod, in April. And he asked me if I'd come over to his house the next day. And he was working on a project. And I said, sure. So I went to his house the next day, and come to find out, the project was his final novel, The Castle in the Forest. And from that, he wanted me to be his editorial aide and do some research for him, but it just sort of blossomed into an all-encompassing personal assistant, if you will, to him. And we developed a really lovely friendship.
Well, I know that food played a role in your friendship. So now you were a waiter. You were a waiter at a restaurant. What kind of restaurant was that? With that, where you met? So you met a
the restaurant was it was a little bistro here in Provincetown. I mean, we have a lot of interesting, fun eateries that are often visited by tourists in the summertime, and then a very few that are open in the off season. And I just happened to be working at one that at the time was open in the off season when he first came in.
Did you instantly recognize him or not?
Well, it was funny because I was kind of in back when he came in, and somebody said, "Oh, Norman Mailer's here." And it was getting kind of late. It was an April night, that first night when we met. And Provincetown in the summertime is a town of 40,000 to 60,000 people, depending on the weekend, but in the off season, in early April, it's dismal. There's maybe 3,500 of us at best, and so a late night is 8 o'clock, and he came in right around 8 or 8:15, and nobody wanted to take the table because they thought, well, everyone knows Mailer's difficult. Well, I didn't have any clue if he was difficult or not, so I came out and I'm like, what's the hubbub? You know, oh, there's a party here, there's four of them, and nobody wanted to stay to take the table. And I was like, well, I'll do it. You know, I didn't care. And I just happened that night to, I had been reading a book that a friend had given to me, which was his novel, The Gospel According to the Son, which is the story of the New Testament, written by him. And so it was just kind of an odd circumstance that I happened to be reading that book that night. But so I waited on him, and we struck up that conversation, and it all worked out from there. And he, when I ran into him years later at the grocery store, he was very smart at summing up people. He knew from looking at the little handbasket that I was carrying, from the contents in it, that I must like to cook. And so when it came to pass that we had the discussion about me being his editorial assistant, he said, well, you like to cook, don't you? And I said, well, yes, I do. So it ended up that I ended up cooking a few nights a week for him and his wife and myself, because I was always there for dinner, invited for dinner and whatnot. And we always had lovely times together. But he loved food. You know, he thought about food as often as he did, as I like to say, man's existence in the universe. It was a big part of his life.
Food. Well, he was a large man, was he not large?
Well, he was always robust. I mean, there's no denying that he was a bit of a stout mass. I mean, he was a ball of muscle until he was, well into his late 60s. He was always an aficionado of boxing, and he used to, when his legs were good, before the arthritis set in so terribly when he was in his, maybe early 70s, he ran all the time up and down Commercial Street, our little avenue here in Provincetown. He was an amazing guy, but he was robust, he was round. But then, of course, as he aged, because I was with him, of course, for 5 years, he thinned out a bit, and of course, towards the end of his life, he got quite thin. But he enjoyed a meal, and he enjoyed his workouts, and he enjoyed his writing, and he enjoyed his family above everything.
He was, I guess he sort of, somebody mentioned in the restaurant that he was difficult, I guess he has the reputation of being a bully, I guess. So, what was he like? Was he a bully?
No, not at all. No, quite the opposite. You know, a lot of that stuff, it came out of the reputation of the man that everyone knew, and I'd say that, the 60s and the 70s. Perhaps he was a bully. He was an intellectual bully. I mean, he was scrappy, too. You know, he was a guy from Brooklyn. He also just happened to be incredibly intelligent. We're talking about a man who won two Pulitzer Prizes, the National Book Award at least once. I'm not even positive if he won it more than that. Every writing award ever presented, except the Nobel. But, that stuff... it all kind of gets blown out of proportion. I often have said to interviewers and people who were curious, that that business in a man's life, especially a man of notoriety, it gets to the point of being legend, and it overshadows the truth. And what I wanted to do with this book, because I was so close to him, was sort of dispel all of that. Because the man I knew was a kind and compassionate, caring, loving man who enjoyed nothing more than a fine meal, his family, his wife, and his work. And that, I think, in the end, is the best that you can say about someone.
Well, when you were hanging around with him, did he reminisce? Did he talk a lot about his past?
Oh, we talked all the time, absolutely. But it was the kind of things that we discussed would be whatever was happening at the moment. Norman didn't really like to live in the past. I mean, he'd bring things up every once in a while about his early days of working, his early days of writing. But he really was a man who, at the advanced age of 80 to 84 years old, which was the time in which I knew him, he was really involved with always keeping his mind electric. He loved new things. He never stopped learning. And, I've met people who are 35 years old who were much older in their head than Norman Mailer was at 83.
We're talking with Duane Raymond, and he's just written a book called Mornings with Mailer, A Recollection of a Friendship. Of Friendship, not A. I've got to say it right. You mentioned the book of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. He was Jewish, but he was very concerned with Christ and Christianity and so forth.
Well, he thought not only about that, he thought about everything. I mean, you have to understand that this man spent his entire life, and he had the luxury of spending his entire life thinking about things in a novelistic manner. Novelists are very odd creatures. They tend to, they can be working while sitting in a car, zipping down the highway in the passenger seat, staring out the window. They're working. Everything that we always sort of think about, novelists do it, except they do it as if they're on steroids, and they bank all this stuff. And he had the luxury, because he gained a certain amount of notoriety and a certain amount of fame and a certain amount of wealth, let's face it, because he was lucky enough to have had a huge bestseller in 1948 called The Naked and the Dead that everyone has read, and is often even suggested to be read in schools now, and has been for years. He had a lot of fame, so he had the luxury to be able to live his life as a writer who worked constantly. And by that I mean he had the chance to not do a 9-to-5 job, to simply write and to contemplate and to think and to make himself better and to always learn. And from him I learned, I like to think, some degree, that ability to really, you know, if you want to be a writer, you've got to do the work. And I saw him work every single day, except for one, up until the time he died.
So he wrote, you know, like the day before he died, he was writing?
He was working, yeah. He really was. The end of his life was the last 2 months of his life was quite troublesome. I mean, I don't want to dwell on that too much. I mean, it is the tale of the end of a life of a terribly important and renowned political man of letters in this country. He hung on. He fought. He worked, and he was in the middle of researching the second volume of that initial book that we had begun together, that began our relationship together on The Castle in the Forest. He was going to do three volumes. He was starting number two.
Was he unrealistic about his life expectancy? I mean, he was 84, 85 when he died. Did he think he would be able to write, you know, two more?
Yeah, you know, Norman didn't really, he didn't necessarily pay attention to a roadblock. You know, he thought, well, I'm going to get better here. But I think at the end, because I was one of the ones who was with him, I was part of the family, literally, at the end. You know, we were all in the room that last day in Mount Sinai in New York, and it was a rather interesting scenario because he was still, he knew what was going on. The failing of the lungs had gotten to be too much, and he was deteriorating rapidly, and it was sad, but at the same time it was almost generously happy because he was in the best of situations because his children were there who he loved dearly, and they're wonderful people, and I was there, and his wife was there, of course, Norris Mailer, and a couple of other people, and he just was full of joy in that room, in himself, in that room, knowing that all of us were there. You know, it was really quite an amazing thing. And then, of course, we all sort of filtered out over the course of the evening, and then he died the following morning at 4:30 in the morning. But he was aware of what was going on, and he had worked literally, writing as best he could up until just days before he entered into the hospital.
Well, the novel that you worked with him at first, that novel, The Castle in the Forest, which is a book about Adolf Hitler as a child.
Well, the youth of Adolf Hitler, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, where was he in the process when you began working with him, and how did you work with him?
Well, he had... He'd read a tremendous amount about Hitler and about World War II and the entire period. And then when I came on, he had written 140 pages of a very, very early draft. And then as I came on to help him do research, he would give me topics, things that he was reading, and he wanted me to investigate further in different avenues, different venues. And so I would do that. I mean, it was a very sort of methodic, but yet low-key way of helping him gain as much knowledge as possible about the minutiae of every little thing that would be involved in this story. And then, of course, there was a period of time where I was chained to the Xerox machine because he would read these huge volumes of biographies and books about what was going on in World War II at the time and what was happening in, Austria in the turn of the century when Hitler was just a boy, and certainly obviously before he had risen to power. But he wanted to know everything, and he would put notes in the margins of these books, and then he'd hand them to me, and I would take the books and Xerox, and I built this wall of files, these thick file folders that were just full of every bit of thing that he could ever think of, and everything that he had found of interest. There were these Xeroxed pages in these files that kept growing, so he would always have them to refer to, and each file was dated with a year. So if he wanted to know what was happening in August of, say, 1912, I had a 3-inch thick file telling him everything that was happening in 1912 that was relevant to the story. And it was such fun to be able to bounce back and forth with him about really what should I include in this file. And he'd say, well, pal, if you think it's relevant, let's get it in there. You know, and of course it was also the copies of the pages of these books that he'd read. And he'd meticulously put a date on a page saying, I think this belongs in such and such a file. And I'd adhere to it, and I would build the files for him. And that went on for every year of Hitler's life, right up until 1945, from the end of the war. Of course, he never got to those files, because that would have been the third volume.
What became of his files?
They're all still there. The house, of course, sits here in Provincetown. It's a lovely old brick house. And it's now a writer's colony, which I think is wonderful. I don't have anything to do with it personally. I have my own life there. It's very hard for me because my life in that house was very personal. That house was full of life when I was there. It was a family home. It was a working man's address. Now, of course, people come there and they study and they get to see the office where we worked, which has been left exactly as it was the last time he was there. It's very interesting that nothing has been moved. But for me personally to go in there, it's somewhat soul-shattering because there was so much joy there, and now it's kind of frozen in time.
We're talking with Duane Raymond, and his book is called Mornings with Mailer, A Recollection of Friendship. Well, what does that house look like, Duane Raymond? Is it a big place, and did Mailer live there a long time?
He did. He bought it, actually, in 1985 or 86, I think. It's a large brick house, three stories, and it sits on the water in Provincetown, which is, of course, as I said earlier, as we were speaking, the very tip of Cape Cod. And Provincetown is an artist community. It's been favored by artists and writers and poets and painters and photographers and you name it for the past 100-plus years. And the house itself, as I said, sits on the water, and it's beautiful, and it's just very homey and lovely. And on the top floor is a dormered attic that's all finished off inside, of course, where his office and his study was. And then his wife, his wife, of course, had the other end of the attic that was her study where she painted and also wrote.
And so when you were working with him, you were more than, as you were saying before, more than just a literary assistant. I mean, you helped him with his travel. You helped him make decisions. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, you know, when you're helping somebody, when you're assisting somebody who's so well-known, the phone calls are always coming in about wanting him to appear at certain events, do various readings and that sort of thing, and so I would schedule all of that, and it was funny, I would use my computer, of course, and he railed against technology. He thought computers were useless, but of course his entire life was was run by computers and the internet and cell phones and all of that, and he knew it logically, but he still thought that something as simple as a cell phone was just the devil's work. He would say that facetiously.
Did he work with a typewriter then, rather than a word?
No. Norman always wrote longhand on good old...
Oh, really?
Plain white 8.5 by 11 typing paper and a black Pilot pen. That was his. Those were his tools. And then he'd pass them over. He'd pass those pages to me.
And you had to type them.
I would read them and I'd make suggestions. And until 2006, he had a secretary in New York, down in Brooklyn, Judith McNally, who also figures into the book. She and I were quite good friends, even though we only met once face-to-face, but that's another story. And I would fax those finished handwritten pages to her, and she would type them up and email them back to me, and then we'd print them out, and he would work from them, and that would go on. Say he'd do a chapter of something or a draft of something, and it would happen 6 or 8 or 10 times back and forth, until he knew he had it just right. That's how meticulous he was. But Judith was one of the ones that she'd been reading his handwriting for 26 years. And Norman, as he aged, his handwriting became quite difficult to read. I mean, when he was younger, certainly, he had beautiful handwriting full of line and loop and swagger. and it was lovely. But as he aged, you know, the terrible thing about aging is that we lose some control of things, and he was no exception to that. And he also wrote furiously fast, and I could tell the more intense he was about a paragraph or a part of his story, when he was caught up in it, his handwriting would become almost frenetic, and it became very difficult to read. So luckily Judith was there, and I would fax his pages to her, and she'd type them up, and I'd look at him and I'd go, oh, that's what he said. I wasn't quite sure sometimes.
And did you then read it to make sure that that's what he had said? You'd read
Oh, absolutely. No, he was meticulous about things. You know, I would read it, he would read it, and I'd make suggestions, and I'd say, you know, I'd say, Norman, I don't really, you know, dude, I don't get this. Because he could be very ethereal about things. He could be very off the wall sometimes, and all based in logic, of course. He was an extremely logical man. But he wanted Castle in the Forest to be accessible. He wanted it to be a read that people could absorb. And he was well aware that some of his works are very hard to read. Mm-hmm. He's a complex man and a complex author. And he wanted Castle, I think, to be really accessible. And so he kind of used me as a bit of a sounding board, somewhat along these lines. You know, if Dwayne doesn't quite get it, or if it's too far out for him, maybe I should rethink it. And, you know, quite frankly, when I would point that out to him, I'd say about 50% of the time he'd go, well, buddy, you're right. All right, let me just work on this. And sure enough, he'd turn it around, and there it was, clear as a bell, exactly whatever point he was trying to get across.
Did he only work on one work at a time, or did he have a lot of things going on at once?
No, actually, he had a lot of things going on at different times. There were always the magazine interviews, the articles, the pieces that he would write outside of the work he was doing on his major novel. And then, of course, right in the middle of, you know, I think I'd been working with him for a couple, 3 months when he decided that he wanted to do a little book of poems and drawings called Modest Gifts, and everything on the novel stopped, and we concentrated on this little book called Modest Gifts for about 2.5 or 3 months, and it was such a joy because it was a whirlwind. It was like being caught up in a tornado of creativity, and I found that to be a wholly exciting time.
Well, how did that happen? How did he suddenly decide he wanted to do that? Was that like, I mean, are we thinking like Picasso, one day he's going to work in clay and the next day he's going to do a drawing? Was it that kind of thing?
Well, he was unpredictable in that way. What had happened was that I was mucking around up in the attic one day doing this and that and filing some things, and I came across a file full of a bunch of fun drawings that he had done, little doodles, and he called them his droons, D-R-O-N-N-S, droons. I have no idea where he came up with that, but anyway. And I said to him, he came up the stairs, and I said, Norman, what are these? And he said, oh, I've been doing them for years. Well, that wasn't much of an explanation. And I was, okay, well, there they are. And then, of course, he had published in 1962 a book called Deaths for the Ladies and Other Disasters, which was a book of kind of obscure poetry and reminiscings and whatnot that he'd written in a time when, you know, New York nightlife in the 60s was just kind of crazy, and he was fully embroiled in all of it. And so I said to him one day, I said, well, gosh, wouldn't it be fun to do a book of just, you know, these wild, lovely, simple drawings that you have? And they would have, the drawings had little captions underneath of them. Some of them were terribly witty. Some of them were very sardonic. Some were politically biting. And I said to him, wouldn't it be fun if we put these all together? And he said, well, I've thought of that. Random House doesn't want a small little book like that. They're looking for a novel. And I said, oh, okay. You know, and I went home, and about 2 weeks later, I came over to the house one day, and I sat down at the table as I did every morning, and he slapped the table and he said, I've got an idea. I think I want to do a book. We're going to put it together. It's poems and drawings. And, you know, and it was suddenly his idea, and that was all well and good. It was such fun, though. And so, you know, I took all those drawings and poems and everything, and he would edit them because some of them were captured I used to say that some of his poems were imprisoned in the language of the time that they were written, which was the early 60s, many of them. And so he re-edited them you know, because he was always thinking forward. He re-edited them and got them out of the trappings of their own time that they were written in. And then he, it was like directing a film for him to put together this book of poems and drawings. It was such a joy to watch him work. And I learned so much from him about how everything must contrast, everything must complement. And that was gorgeous. It was a lovely lesson. And I write about that in the book as well, because it was really sort of the introduction to seeing how his mind worked.
Well, Duane Raymond, did Norman Mailer know that you would write this book, Mornings with Mailer?
No, he didn't. In fact, I didn't know I was going to write this book. I never intended really to write a book. You know, when I began working with Norman, the second we had become acquainted, he, to me, was a friend. And, you know, it came to pass that after he died, an editor at Random House, who I was friendly with, I was in his office one day in New York, and he said, he thought about doing a book, and Norman had been gone for less than a month, really, at this point. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. And a couple months later, I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I really don't want this time to be lost. And I'm not saying just for me. I didn't want it to be lost for me. I recognized after the fact that I had been in a really unique position. You know, I'd been right-hand man and editorial assistant and confidant to one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, one of the greatest men of letters the 20th century has ever known. And I thought, you know what, this intimate side of him in this last 5 years, as he was still very prolific, I mean, 4 books came out of that period. You know, I was lucky enough to be there. I was heavily involved in all of this, and I thought, I don't want this time to be lost. And the longer I wait to do this, the more it's going to fritter away in my mind, and I'm not going to remember it. And I was lucky enough, because I've always kept journals, that I had copious journals of some of our conversations. I would have scribbled down, because in the course of the day we would talk about things. So I did have a bank of information, and finally I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. And through circumstances, the book actually ended up at HarperCollins, which was lovely. And they've been very, you know, quite good to me. I didn't initially want to even write the book. But then I realized that when I got involved with it, it was a cathartic experience, because I relived the years, put it down, and then put it away. But at the end, I realized after it was done, and now when I look at the book, I go, oh my God, it's such a lovely, graceful look at a time of, you know, this younger man learning from an older man how to be a better man. I mean, that's really what the book is about. Norman is at the core of this book, but it's also a book about family and relationships and the mentor that we all have in our life, whether it be a teacher or a friend or a distant relative who has kind of taken us under their wing for a little bit of time and taught us about life. Because really, it goes beyond my book anyway. Mornings with Mailer goes beyond just simply about what it was with Norman. I use him as in our relationship as the backdrop, of course. But those who have read it and written to me from all over the place now, all over the country, even as far away as Turkey, have all said that there's been little things in here that have just touched us that we didn't understand. We didn't know that that's what this book was about. And it really does kind of flatter me that they say that. And I think that's, it came out that way because I really wanted to be honest about so many things. And in no way, shape, or form is this book salacious. And I don't get into the kind of strangeness that may have occurred in Norman Mailer's life before I ever knew him. This is about the period that I was there and sort of the graceful period that we all spent here in Provincetown working and knowing each other. And finally, you know, when that mentor of mine, that husband, that great father of those children, you know, when he finally passed away. The book is about that.
And the book is called Mornings with Mailer, A Recollection of Friendship, and the author, Duane Raymond. Thank you so much for spending some time on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it was my pleasure, absolutely.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back again next week for another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes or Facebook. I want to thank Duane Raymond, author of Mornings with Mailer, A Recollection of Friendship, for being my guest this week. And special thanks also for help this week to Donna Gould. As always, I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.